The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, June 8th, 2017. You guessed it, guys. It's Comey versus the committee with no bull. Every question, every answer that elicited new information, and none of the rest. We included opening statements from Richard Burr, chairman of the committee, and Mark Warner, the ranking member, because they show the center of gravity of the committee's thinking as they go into the discussion with the former FBI director. But we cut out all the repetition. We left in only the pieces of information that actually advanced the conversation as the former fired FBI director faced the Senate Intelligence Committee today about his interactions with President Trump. It's the Lawfare Podcast episode I don't even know anymore. Comey versus the committee with no bull.
Director Comey, I appreciate your willingness to appear before the committee today, and more importantly, I thank you for your dedicated service and leadership to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Your appearance today speaks to the trust we have built over the years, and I'm looking forward to a very open and candid discussion today. Jim, allegations have been swirling in the press for the last several weeks, and today's your opportunity to set the record straight. Yesterday, I read with interest your statement for the record, and I think it provides some helpful details surrounding your interactions with the president. It clearly lays out your understanding of those discussions, actions you took following each conversation, and your state of mind. I very much appreciate your candor, and I think it's helpful as we work through to determine the ultimate truth behind possible Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Your statement also provides texture and context to your interactions with the president from your vantage point and outlines a strained relationship. The American people need to hear your side of the story, just as they need to hear the president's descriptions of events. These interactions also highlight the importance of the committee's ongoing investigation. Our experienced staff is interviewing all relevant parties and some of the most sensitive intelligence in our country's possession. We will establish the facts, separate from rampant speculation, and lay them out for the American people to make their own judgment. Only then will we, as a nation, be able to move forward and to put this episode to rest. There are several outstanding issues not addressed in your statement that I hope you'll clear up for the American people today. Did the president's request for loyalty, your impression, that the one-on-one dinner of January 27th was, and I quote, at least in part, an effort to create some sort of patronage relationship, or his March 30th phone call asking what you could do to lift the cloud of Russia investigation in any way, alter your approach or the FBI's investigation into General Flynn, or the broader investigation into Russia and possible links to the campaign? In your opinion, did potential Russian efforts to establish links with individuals in the Trump orbit rise to the level we could define as collusion, or was it a counterintelligence concern? There's been a significant public speculation about your decision making related to the Clinton email investigation? Why did you decide publicly to publicly announce FBI's recommendations that the Department of Justice not pursue criminal charges? You have described it as a choice between a bad decision and a worse decision. The American people need to understand the facts behind your action. This committee is uniquely suited to investigate Russia's interference in the 2016 elections. We also have a unified bipartisan approach to what is a highly charged partisan issue. Russian activities during 2016 election may have been aimed at one party's candidate, but as my colleague Senator Rubio says frequently, in 2018 and 2020, it could be aimed at anyone at home or abroad. My colleague Senator Warner and I have worked to stay in lockstep on this investigation. We've had our differences on approach at times, but I've constantly stressed that we need to be a team, and I think Senator Warner agrees with me. We must keep these questions above politics and partisanship. It's too important to be tainted by anyone trying to score political points. With that, again, I welcome you, Director, and I turn to the Vice Chairman for any comments he might have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me start by, again, absolutely thanking all the members of the committee for the seriousness in which they've taken on this task. Mr. Comey, thank you for agreeing to come testify as part of this committee's investigation into Russia. I realize that this hearing has been obviously the focus of a lot of Washington in the last few days. But the truth is, many Americans who may be tuning in today probably haven't focused on every twist and turn of the investigation. So I'd like to briefly describe, at least from this senator's standpoint, what we already know and what we're still investigating. To be clear, this investigation is not about relitigating the election. It's not about who won or lost, and it sure as heck is not about Democrats versus Republicans. We're here because a foreign adversary attacked us right here at home, plain and simple, not by guns or missiles, but by foreign operatives seeking to hijack our most important democratic process, our presidential election. Russian spies engaged in a series of online cyber raids and a broad campaign of disinformation, all ultimately aimed at sowing chaos to undermine public faith in our process, in our leadership, and ultimately in ourselves. And that's not just this senator's opinion. It is the unanimous determination of the entire U.S. intelligence community. So we must find out the full story. What the Russians did, and candidly, as some other colleagues have mentioned, why they were so successful. And more importantly, we must determine the necessary steps to take to protect our democracy and ensure they can't do it again. Chairman mentioned elections in 2018 and 2020. In my home state of Virginia, we have elections this year in 2017. Simply put, we cannot let anything or anyone prevent us from getting to the bottom of this. Now, Mr. Comey, let me say at the outset, we haven't always agreed on every issue. In fact, I've occasionally questioned some of the actions you've taken. But I've never had any reason to question your integrity, your expertise, or your intelligence. You've been a straight shooter with this committee and have been willing to speak truth to power, even at the risk of your own career, which makes the way in which you were fired by the president ultimately shocking. Recall we began this entire process with the president and his staff first denying that the Russians were ever involved and then falsely claiming that no one from his team was ever in touch with any Russians. We know that's just not the truth. Numerous Trump associates had undisclosed contacts with Russians before and after the election, including the president's attorney general, his former national security advisor, and his current senior advisor, Mr. Kushner. That doesn't even begin to count the host of additional campaign associates and advisors who've also been caught up in this massive web. We saw Mr. Trump's campaign manager, Mr. Manafort, forced to step down over ties to Russian-backed entities. The National Security Advisor, General Flynn, had to resign over his lies about engagements with the Russians. And we saw the candidate himself express an odd and unexplained affection for the Russian dictator while calling for the hacking of his opponent. There's a lot to investigate. Enough, in fact, that then-Director Comey publicly acknowledged that he was leading an investigation into those links between Mr. Trump's campaign and the Russian government. As the director of the FBI, Mr. Comey was ultimately responsible for conducting that investigation, which might explain why you're sitting now as a private citizen. What we didn't know was at the same time that this investigation was proceeding, the president himself appears to have been engaged in an effort to influence or at least co-opt the director of the FBI. The testimony that Mr. Comey has submitted for today's hearing is very disturbing. For example, on January 27th, after summoning Director Comey to dinner, the president appears to have threatened the director's job while telling him, quote, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty." At a later meeting, on February 14th, the president asked the attorney general to leave the Oval Office so that he could privately ask Director Comey, again, quote, to see way clear to letting Flynn go. That is a statement that Director Comey interpreted as a request that he drop the investigation connected to General Flynn's false statements. Think about it. The President of the United States asking the FBI director to drop an ongoing investigation. And after that, the President called the FBI director on two additional occasions, March 30th and April 11th, and asked him again, quote, to lift the cloud on the Russia investigation. Now, Director Comey denied each of these improper requests. The loyalty pledge, the admonition to drop the Flynn investigation, the request to lift the cloud on the Russia investigation. Of course, after his refusals, Director Comey was fired. The initial explanation for the firing didn't pass any smell test. Somehow, Director Comey was fired because he didn't treat Hillary Clinton appropriately. Of course, that explanation lasted about a day because the president himself then made very clear that he was thinking about Russia when he decided to fire Director Comey. Shockingly, reports suggest that the president admitted as much in an Oval Office meeting with the Russians the day after Director Comey was fired. Disparaging our country's top law enforcement official as a quote-unquote nut job, the president allegedly suggested that his firing relieved great pressure on his feelings about Russia. This is not happening in isolation. At the same time the president was engaged in these efforts with Director Comey, he was also, at least allegedly, asking senior leaders of the intelligence community to downplay the Russian investigation or to intervene with the director. Yesterday, we had DNI Director Coates and NSA Director Admiral Rogers, who were offered a number of opportunities to flatly deny those press reports. They expressed their opinions, but they did not take that opportunity to deny those reports. They did not take advantage of that opportunity. In my belief, that's not how the President of the United States should behave. Regardless of the outcome of our investigation into the Russia links, Director Comey's firing and his testimony raise separate and troubling questions that we must get to the bottom of. Again, as I said at the outset, I've seen firsthand how seriously every member of this committee is taking his work. I'm proud of the committee's efforts so far. Let me be clear. This is not a witch hunt. This is not fake news. It is an effort to protect our country from a new threat that, quite honestly, will not go away anytime soon. So, Mr. Comey, your testimony here today will help us move towards that goal. I look forward to that testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ranking Member Warner, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here to testify today. I've submitted my statement for the record, and I'm not going to repeat it here this morning. I thought I would just offer some very brief introductory remarks, and then I would welcome your questions. When I was appointed FBI director in 2013, I understood that I served at the pleasure of the president. Even though I was appointed to a 10-year term, which Congress created in order to underscore the importance of the FBI being outside of politics and independent, I understood that I could be fired by a president for any reason or for no reason at all. And on May the 9th, when I learned that I had been fired, for that reason, I immediately came home as a private citizen. But then the explanations, the shifting explanations, confused me and increasingly concerned me. They confused me because the president and I had had multiple conversations about my job, both before and after he took office. And he had repeatedly told me I was doing a great job and he hoped I would stay. And I had repeatedly assured him that I did intend to stay and serve out the remaining 6 years of my term. He told me repeatedly that he had talked to lots of people about me, including our current attorney general, and had learned that I was doing a great job and that I was extremely well-liked by the FBI workforce. So it confused me when I saw on television the president saying that he actually fired me because of the Russia investigation, and learned again from the media that he was telling privately other parties that my firing had relieved great pressure on the Russia investigation. I was also confused by the initial explanation that was offered publicly, that I was fired because of the decisions I had made during the election year. That didn't make sense to me for a whole bunch of reasons, including the time and all the water that had gone under the bridge since those hard decisions that had to be made. That didn't make any sense to me. And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. And I am so sorry that the FBI workforce had to hear them, and I'm so sorry that the American people were told them. I worked every day at the FBI to help make that great organization better. And I say help because I did nothing alone at the FBI. There are no indispensable people at the FBI. The organization's great strength is that its values and abilities run deep and wide. The FBI will be fine without me. The FBI's mission will be relentlessly pursued by its people, and that mission is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution of the United States. I will deeply miss being part of that mission, but this organization and its mission will go on long beyond me and long beyond any particular administration. I have a message before I close for my former colleagues of the FBI, but at first I want the American people to know this truth. The FBI is honest. The FBI is strong. And the FBI is and always will be independent. And now to my former colleagues, if I may. I am so sorry that I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to you properly. It was the honor of my life to serve beside you, to be part of the FBI family, and I will miss it for the rest of my life. Thank you for standing watch. Thank you for doing so much good for this country. Do that good as long as ever you can.
Director, did the special counsel's office review and or edit your written testimony?
No.
Do you have any doubt that Russia attempted to interfere in the 2016 elections?
None.
Do you have any doubt that the Russian government was behind the intrusions in the DNC and the DCCC systems and the subsequent leaks of that information?
No, no doubt.
Do you have any doubt that the Russian government was behind the cyber intrusion into state voter files?
No.
Do you have any doubt that officials of the Russian government were fully aware of these activities?
No doubt.
Are you confident that no votes cast in the 2016 presidential election were altered?
I'm confident. By the time when I left as director, I had seen no indication of that whatsoever.
Did the president at any time ask you to stop the FBI investigation into Russian involvement in the 2016 U.S. elections?
Not to my understanding, no.
Did any individual working for this administration, including the Justice Department, ask you to stop the Russian investigation?
No.
General Flynn had an unreported contact with the Russians, which is an offense. And if press accounts are right, there might have been discrepancies between facts and his FBI testimony. In your estimation, was General Flynn at that time in serious legal jeopardy? And in addition to that, do you sense that the president was trying to obstruct justice or just seek for a way for Mike Flynn to save face, given he had already been fired?
Well, General Flynn at that point in time was in legal jeopardy. There was an open FBI criminal investigation of his statements in connection with the Russian contacts and the contacts themselves. And so that was my assessment at the time. I don't think it's for me to say whether the conversation I had with the president was an effort to obstruct. I took it as a very disturbing thing, very concerning, but that's a conclusion I'm sure the special counsel will work towards to try and understand what the intention was there and whether that's an offense.
Director, is it possible that as part of this FBI investigation, the FBI could find evidence of criminality that is not tied to the 2016 elections, possible collusion, or coordination with Russians?
Sure.
So there could be something that just fits a criminal aspect to this that doesn't have anything to do with the 2016 election cycle.
Correct. In any complex investigation, when you start turning over rocks, sometimes you find things that are unrelated to the primary investigation that are criminal in nature.
Director Comey, you have been criticized publicly for the decision to present your findings on the email investigation directly to the American people. Have you learned anything since that time that would have changed what you said or how you chose to inform the American people?
Honestly, no. I mean, it caused a whole lot of personal pain for me, but as I look back, given what I knew at the time and even what I've learned since, I think it was the best way to try and protect the justice institution, including the FBI.
In the public domain is this question of the Steele dossier, a document that has been around now for over a year. At the time of your departure from the FBI, was the FBI able to confirm any criminal allegations contained in the Steele document?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's a question I can answer in an open setting because it goes into the details of the investigation.
The term we hear most often is collusion. When people are describing possible links between Americans and Russian government entities related to the interference in our election, would you say that it's normal for foreign governments to reach out to members of an incoming administration?
Yes.
At what point does the normal contact cross the line into an attempt to recruit agents or influence or spies?
Difficult to say in the abstract. It depends upon the context, whether there's an effort to keep it covert, or what the nature of the requests made of the American by the foreign government are. It's a judgment call based on a whole lot of facts.
At what point would that recruitment become a counterintelligence threat to our country?
When a foreign power is using especially coercion or some sort of pressure to try and co-opt an American, especially a government official, to act on its behalf, that's a serious concern to the FBI and at the heart of the FBI's counterintelligence mission.
So if you've got a 36-page document of specific claims that are out there, the FBI would have to, for counterintelligence reasons, try to verify anything that might be claimed in there. One, and probably first and foremost, is the counterintelligence concerns that we have about blackmail. Would that be an accurate statement?
Yes. If the FBI receives a credible allegation that there is some effort to co-opt, coerce, direct, employ covertly an American on behalf of the foreign power, that's the basis on which a counterintelligence investigation is opened.
And when you read the dossier, when did you become aware of the cyber intrusion?
There's all kinds of cyber intrusions going on all the time. The first Russia-connected cyber intrusion I became aware of in the late summer of 2015.
And in that time frame, there were more than the DNC and the DCCC that were targets.
Correct. There was a massive effort to target government and non-governmental, near-governmental agencies like nonprofits.
What would be the estimate of how many entities out there the Russians specifically targeted in that time frame?
It's hundreds. I suppose it could be more than 1,000, but it's at least hundreds.
When did you become aware that data had been exfiltrated?
I'm not sure exactly. I think either late 15 or early 16.
And did you, the director of the FBI, have conversations with the last administration about the risk that this posed?
Yes.
And share with us, if you will, what actions they took.
Well, the FBI had already undertaken an effort to notify all the victims, and that's what we consider the entities that were attacked as part of this massive spear phishing campaign. And so we notified them in an effort to disrupt what might be ongoing. And then there was a series of continuing interactions with entities through the rest of 15 into 16. And then throughout 16, the administration was trying to decide how to respond to the intrusion activity that it saw.
And the FBI in this case, unlike other cases that you might investigate, did you ever have access to the actual hardware that was hacked, or did you have to rely on a third party to provide you the data that they had collected?
In the case of the DNC, and I believe the DCCC, but I'm sure the DNC, we did not have access to the devices themselves. We got relevant forensic information from a private party, a high-class entity that had done the work, but we didn't get direct access.
But no content?
Correct.
Isn't content an important part of the forensics from a counterintelligence standpoint?
It is, although what was briefed to me by my folks, the people who were my folks at the time, is that they had gotten the information from the private party that they needed to understand the intrusion by the spring of 2016.
Was your decision influenced by the Attorney General's tarmac meeting with the former President Bill Clinton?
Yes, in a ultimately conclusive way. That was the thing that capped it for me, that I had to do something separately to protect the credibility of the investigation, which meant both the FBI and the Justice Department.
Were there other things that contributed to that you can describe in an open session?
There were other things that contributed to that. But I guess I can talk about an open setting is that at one point the Attorney General had directed me not to call it an investigation, but instead to call it a matter, which confused me and concerned me. But that was one of the bricks in the load that led me to conclude I have to step away from the department if we're to close this case credibly.
Is there any doubt in your mind that this committee can carry out its oversight role in the 2016 Russian involvement in the elections in parallel with the now special counsel that's been set up?
No doubt. It can be done. It requires lots of conversations. But Bob Mueller is one of this country's great, great pros, and I'm sure you all will be able to work it out with him to run it in parallel.
I want to thank you once again. I want to turn to the Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's start with the January 6th meeting. Now, you said after that briefing, you felt compelled to document that conversation, that you actually started documenting it as soon as you got into the car. Now, you've had extensive experience at the Department of Justice and at the FBI. You've worked under presidents of both parties. What was it about that meeting that led you to determine that you needed to start putting down a written record?
A combination of things. I think the circumstances, the subject matter, and the person I was interacting with. Circumstances first, I was alone with the President of the United States, or the President-elect, soon to be President. The subject matter, I was talking about matters that touch on the FBI's core responsibility and that relate to the president-elect personally, and then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document. That combination of things I'd never experienced before, but it led me to believe I got to write it down, and I got to write it down in a very detailed way.
Then, again, unlike your dealings with presidents of either parties in your past experience, in every subsequent meeting or conversation with this president, you created a written record. Did you feel that you needed to create this written record of these memos because they might need to be relied on at some future date?
Sure. I created records after conversations, and I think I did it after each of our 9 conversations. If I didn't, I did it for nearly all of them, especially the ones that were substantive. I knew that there might come a day when I would need a record of what had happened, not just to defend myself, but to defend the FBI and our integrity as an institution and the independence of our investigative function.
That you felt like in every meeting you needed a document because at some point, using your words, he might put out a non-truthful representation of that meeting.
Now, that's right, Senator. And I, as I said in my written testimony, as FBI director, I interacted with President Obama, and I spoke only twice in 3 years and didn't document it. When I was Deputy Attorney General, I had one one-on-one meeting with President Bush about a very important and difficult national security matter. I didn't write a memo documenting that conversation either. Sent a quick email to my staff to let them know there was something going on.
You are asked to, in effect, indicate whether the president was the subject of any investigation. And my understanding is prior to your meeting on January 6th, you discussed with your leadership team whether or not you should be prepared to assure then-President-elect Trump that the FBI was not investigating him personally. Now, my understanding is your leadership team agreed with that, but was that a unanimous decision? Was there any debate about that?
It wasn't unanimous. One of the members of the leadership team had a view that although it was technically true, we did not have a counterintelligence file case open on then-President-elect Trump. His concern was, because we're looking at the potential, again, that's the subject of the investigation, coordination between the campaign and Russia, because it was President Trump, President-elect Trump's campaign, this person's view was inevitably his behavior, his conduct, will fall within the scope of that work. And so he was reluctant to make the statement that I made. I disagreed. I thought it was fair to say what was literally true. There is not a counterintelligence investigation of Mr. Trump. And I decided in the moment to say it, given the nature of our conversation.
At that moment in time, did you ever revisit that as in the subsequent sessions?
With the FBI leadership
with the team?
Sure.
With the team.
And the leader who had that view, it didn't change. His view was still that it was probably, although literally true, his concern was it could be misleading because the nature of the investigation was such that it might well touch, obviously it would touch the campaign, and the person at the head of the campaign would be the candidate. And so that was his view throughout.
Let me move to the January 27th dinner. What was your impression and what did you mean by this notion of a patronage relationship?
Well, my impression, and again, it's my impression, I could always be wrong, but my common sense told me that what was going on is either he had concluded or someone had told him that you've already asked Comey to stay and you didn't get anything for it. And that the dinner was an effort to build a relationship, in fact, he asked specifically, of loyalty in the context of asking me to stay. And as I said, what was odd about that is we'd already talked twice about it by that point. And he'd said, I very much hope you'll stay. I hope you'll stay. In fact, I just remembered sitting here, a third one. When you've seen the picture of me walking across the blue room, what the president whispered in my ear was, I really look forward to working with you. So after those encounters.
And that was just a few days before you were fired.
Yeah, that was on the Sunday after the inauguration. The next Friday, I have dinner, and the president begins by wanting to talk about my job. And so I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, 3 times you've already asked me to stay or talked about me staying. My common sense, again, I could be wrong, but my common sense told me what's going on here is he's looking to get something in exchange for granting my request to stay in the job.
You ever had any of those kind of requests before from anyone else you'd worked for in the government?
No. And what made me uneasy was I'm, at that point, the director of the FBI. The reason that Congress created a 10-year term is so that the director is not feeling as if they're serving with political loyalty owed to any particular person. The statue of justice has a blindfold on because you're not supposed to be peeking out to see whether your patron is pleased or not with what you're doing. It should be about the facts and the law. That's why I became FBI director, to be in that kind of position. So that's why I was so uneasy.
Well, let me move on. My time's running out. February 14th, again, it seems a bit strange. You were in a meeting. And your direct superior, the Attorney General, was in that meeting as well. Yet the president asked everyone to leave, including the Attorney General to leave, before he brought up the matter of General Flynn. What was your impression of that type of action? Had you ever seen anything like that before?
No. My impression was something big is about to happen. I need to remember every single word that is spoken. My sense was the Attorney General knew he shouldn't be leaving, which is why he was lingering. And I don't know Mr. Kushner well, but I think he picked up on the same thing. And so I knew something was about to happen that I needed to pay very close attention to.
And I found it very interesting that in the memo that you wrote after this February 14th pull-aside, you made clear that you wrote that memo in a way that was unclassified. If you affirmatively made the decision to write a memo that was unclassified, was that because you felt at some point the facts of that meeting would have to come clean and come clear and actually be able to be cleared in a way that could be shared with the American people?
Well, I remember thinking this is a very disturbing development, really important to our work. I need to document it and preserve it in a way, and this committee gets this, but sometimes when things are classified, it tangles them up. It's hard
Amen.
To share it within an investigative team. You have to be very careful about how you handle it for good reason. So my thinking was if I write it in such a way that I don't include anything that would trigger a classification, that'll make it easier for us to discuss within the FBI and the government and to hold on to it in a way that makes it accessible to us.
How many ongoing investigations at any time does the FBI have?
Oh, going tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Did the president ever ask about any other ongoing investigation?
No.
Did he ever ask about you trying to interfere on any other investigation?
No. I had one conversation with the president that was classified where he asked about an ongoing intelligence investigation. It was brief and entirely professional.
But he didn't ask you to take any specific action on that?
No.
Unlike what he had done vis-a-vis Mr. Flynn and the overall Russia investigation?
Correct.
Senator Risch.
Thank you very much. Mr. Comey, thank you for your service. I gather from all this that you're willing to say now that while you were director, the President of the United States was not under investigation. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct.
All right. So that's a fact that we can rely on at this
point. Yes, sir.
Okay. I remember you talked with us shortly after February 14th when the New York Times wrote an article that suggested that the Trump campaign was colluding with the Russians. You remember reading that article when it first came out?
I do. It was about allegedly extensive electronic surveillance.
Correct.
Communications. Yes.
And that upset you to the point where you actually went out and surveyed the intelligence community to see whether you were missing something in that. Is that correct?
That's correct. I want to be careful in open setting.
I'm not going to go any further than that.
Okay.
So thank you. In addition to that, after that, you sought out both Republican and Democrat senators to tell them that, hey, I don't know where this is coming from, but this is not the case. This is not factual. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. So again, so the American people can understand this, that report by the New York Times was not true. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, in the main, it was not true. And again, all of you know this, maybe the American people don't. The challenge, and I'm not picking on reporters, about writing stories about classified information is the people talking about it often don't really know what's going on, and those of us who actually know what's going on are not talking about it. And we don't call the press to say, hey, you got that thing wrong about this sensitive topic. We just have to leave it there. I mentioned to the chairman the nonsense around what influenced me to make the July 5th statement. Nonsense, but I can't go explaining how it's nonsense.
Thank you. All right. So those three things we now know regarding the active measures with the president's under investigation and the collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And, boy, you nailed this down on page 5, paragraph 3. You put this in quotes. Words matter. You wrote down the words so we can all have the words in front of us now. There's 28 words there that are in quotes, and it says, quote, I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go. Now, those are his exact words. Is that correct?
Correct.
And you wrote them here and you put them in quotes?
Correct.
Okay. He did not direct you to let it go?
Not in his words, no.
He did not order you to let it go?
Again, those words are not an order.
No. He said, I hope. Do you know of any case where a person has been charged for obstruction of justice, or for that matter, any other criminal offense, where this they said or thought they hoped for an outcome?
I don't know well enough to answer. And the reason I keep saying his words is I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the President of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
You may have taken it as a direction, but that's not what he said.
Correct.
He said, I hope.
Those are exact words. Okay. Correct.
Senator Feinstein.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman. Why do you believe you were fired?
I guess I don't know for sure. I believe I take the president at his word that I was fired because of the Russia investigation.
Let's go to the Flynn. Now, here's the question. I know the Oval Office, and I know what happens to people when they walk in. There is a certain amount of intimidation. But why didn't you stop and say, Mr. President, this is wrong. I cannot discuss this with you.
I was so stunned by the conversation that I just took it in. And the only thing I could think to say, because I was playing in my mind, because I was going to remember every word he said, I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes. I remember saying, I agree he's a good guy, as a way of saying I'm not agreeing with what you just asked me to do.
You described two phone calls that you received from President Trump, one on March 30 and one on April 11, where he, quote, described the Russia investigation as a cloud that was impairing his ability, end quote, as president, and asked you, quote, to lift the cloud, end quote. How did you interpret that? And what did you believe he wanted you to do?
I interpreted that as he was frustrated that the Russia investigation was taking up so much time and energy, and it was making it difficult for him to focus on other priorities of his. But what he asked me was actually narrower than that. So I think what he meant by the cloud, and again, I could be wrong, but what I think he meant by the cloud was the entire investigation is taking up oxygen and making it hard for me to focus on the things I want to focus on. The ask was to get it out that I, the president, am not personally under investigation.
You told the president, I would see what we could do. What did you mean?
I was kind of a slightly cowardly way of trying to avoid telling him we're not going to do that, that I would see what we could do. It was a way of kind of getting off the phone, frankly. And then I turned and handed it to the acting Deputy Attorney General, Mr. Bente.
So I wanted to go into that. Who did you talk with about that, lifting the cloud, stopping the investigation back at the FBI, and what was their response?
Well, the FBI, during one of the two conversations, I'm not remembering exactly, I think the first, my chief of staff was actually sitting in front of me and heard my end of the conversation because the president's call was a surprise. And I discussed the lifting the cloud and the request with the senior leadership team, who typically, and I think in all these circumstances, was the deputy director, my chief of staff, the general counsel, the deputy director's chief counsel, and I think in a number of circumstances, the number three in the FBI, and a few of the conversations included the head of the National Security Branch. So they were very concerned. And then the conversation turned to about, so what should we do with this information?
Senator Rubio.
At the time, did you say anything to the president about that is not an appropriate request, or did you tell the White House counsel that is not an appropriate request, someone needs to go tell the president that he can't do these things?
I didn't, no.
Okay. Why?
But in the moment, it didn't come to my mind. What came to my mind is be careful what you say.
So on the cloud, we keep talking about this cloud. You perceive the cloud to be the Russian investigation in general.
Yes, sir. Right?
But the specific ask was that you would tell the American people what you had already told him, what you had already told the leaders of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, that he was not personally under investigation.
Yes, sir.
That's in fact, he was asking you to do what you have done here today.
Correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. And again, at that setting, did you say to the president that it would be inappropriate for you to do so and then talk to the White House counsel or anybody so hopefully they would talk to him and tell him that he couldn't do this?
First time I said, I'll see what we can do. Second time, I explained how it should work, that the White House counsel should contact the Deputy Attorney General.
You told him
the president said, okay, then I think that's what I'll do.
And just to be clear, for you to make a public statement that he was not under investigation would not have been illegal, but you felt it made no sense because it could potentially create a duty to correct if circumstances changed.
Yes, sir. If we say the president and the vice president aren't under investigation, what's the principled basis for stopping?
Okay.
And so the leadership at Justice, acting Attorney General Bente, said you're not going to do that.
Now, on March 30th, during the phone call about General Flynn, you said he abruptly shifted and brought up something that you call, quote unquote, the McCabe thing. Had the president at any point in time expressed to you concern, opposition, potential opposition to McCabe?
He had asked me during previous conversations about Andy McCabe, and I assured the president Andy is a total pro.
So then the president turns to you and says, remember, I never brought up the McCabe thing because you said he was a good guy. Did you perceive that to be a statement that I took care of you, so now, you know, I'm asking you potentially for something in return? Is that how you perceived it?
I wasn't sure what to make of it, honestly. That's possible, but it was so out of context that I didn't have a clear view of what it was.
We learn more from the newspapers sometimes than we do from our open hearings, for sure. You ever wonder why, of all the things in this investigation, the only thing that's never been leaked is the fact that the president was not personally under investigation, despite the fact that both Democrats and Republicans and the leadership of Congress knew that and have known that for weeks?
I don't know. I find matters that are briefed to the Gang of Eight are pretty tightly held, in my experience.
Senator Wyden.
Let me turn to the Attorney General. In your statement, you said that you and the FBI leadership team decided not to discuss the president's actions with Attorney General Sessions, even though he had not recused himself. What was it about the Attorney General's own interactions with the Russians or his behavior with regard to the investigation that would have led the entire leadership of the FBI to make this decision?
Our judgment, as I recall, was that he was very close to and inevitably going to recuse himself for a variety of reasons. We also were aware of facts that I can't discuss in an open setting that would make his continued engagement in a Russia-related investigation problematic. And so we were convinced, and in fact, I think we'd already heard that the career people were recommending that he recuse himself, that he was not going to be in contact with Russia-related matters much longer. And that turned out to be the case.
How would you characterize Attorney General Sessions' adherence to his recusal, in particular with regard to his involvement in your firing, which the president has acknowledged was because of the Russian investigation?
That's a question I can't answer. I think it's a reasonable question. If, as the president said, I was fired because of the Russian investigation, why was the Attorney General involved in that chain? I don't know. And so I don't have an answer for the question.
Had the president got what he wanted and what he asked of you, what would have been the effect on the investigation?
Well, we would have closed any investigation of General Flynn in connection with his statements about and encounters with Russians in the late part of December. So we would have dropped an open criminal investigation.
Vice President Pence was the head of the transition. To your knowledge, was he aware of the concerns about Michael Flynn prior to or during General Flynn's tenure as National Security Advisor?
I don't. You're asking, including up to the time when Flynn was forced to resign? My understanding is that he was, and I would assume yes.
Senator Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want first to ask you about your conversations with the president, the three conversations in which you told him that he was not under investigation. The first was during your January 6th meeting, according to your testimony, in which it appears that you actually volunteered that assurance. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Did you limit that statement to counterintelligence investigations, or were you talking about any kind of FBI investigation?
I didn't use the term counterintelligence. I was speaking to him and briefing him about some salacious and unverified material. It was in the context of that he had a strong and defensive reaction about that not being true. And my reading of it was important for me to assure him we were not personally investigating him. And so the context then was actually narrower, focused on what I just talked to him about. But it was very important because it was, first, true. And second, I was worried very much about being in kind of a J. Edgar Hoover type situation. I didn't want him thinking that I was briefing him on this to sort of hang it over him in some way. I was briefing him on it because we had been told by the media it was about to launch. We didn't want to be keeping that from him. And if there was some, he needed to know this was being said. But I was very keen not to leave him with an impression that the Bureau was trying to do something to him. And so that's the context in which I said, sir, we're not personally investigating you.
And that's why you volunteered the information.
Yes, ma'am.
Correct. Then on the January 27th dinner, you told the president that he should be careful about asking you to investigate because, quote, you might create a narrative that we are investigating him personally, which we weren't. Again, were you limiting that statement to counterintelligence investigations or more broadly, such as a criminal investigation?
The context was very similar. I didn't modify the word investigation. It was, again, he was reacting strongly again to that unverified material, saying, I'm tempted to order you to investigate it. And that, in the context of that, I said, sir, you want to be careful about that because it might create a narrative we're investigating you personally.
And then there was the March 30th phone call with the president in which you reminded him that congressional leaders have been briefed that we were not personally, the FBI was not personally investigating President Trump. And again, was that statement to congressional leaders and to the president limited to counterintelligence investigations, or was it a broader statement? I'm trying to understand whether there was any kind of investigation of the president underway.
No. I'm sorry. And if I misunderstood, I apologize. We briefed the congressional leadership about what Americans we had opened counterintelligence investigation cases on, and we specifically said the president is not one of those Americans, but that there was no other investigation of the president that we were not mentioning at that time. What the context was counterintelligence, but I wasn't trying to hide some criminal investigation of the president.
And was the president under investigation at the time of your dismissal on May 9th?
No.
Later on, upon reflection, did you go to anyone at the Department of Justice and ask them to call the White House counsel's office and explain that the president had to have a far better understanding and appreciation of his role vis-a-vis the FBI?
In general, I did. I spoke to the Attorney General, and I spoke to the new Deputy Attorney General, Mr. Rosenstein, when he took office, and explained my serious concern about the way in which the president is interacting, especially with the FBI. And I specifically, as I said in my testimony, told the Attorney General, it can't happen that you get kicked out of the room and the president talks to me. But look, in the room, but why didn't we raise the specific? It was of investigative interest to us to try and figure out, so what just happened with the president's request? So I would not have wanted to alert the White House that it had happened until we figured out, what are we going to do with this investigatively?
And finally, did you show copies of your memos to anyone outside of the Department of Justice?
Yes.
And to whom did you show copies?
I asked, President tweeted on Friday after I got fired that I better hope there's not tapes. I woke up in the middle of the night on Monday night, because it didn't dawn on me originally, that there might be corroboration for our conversation. There might be a tape. And my judgment was I needed to get that out into the public square. And so I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. Didn't do it myself for a variety of reasons, but I asked him to because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel. And so I asked a close friend of mine to do it.
And was that Mr. Wittes?
No.
Who was that?
A good friend of mine who's a professor at Columbia Law School.
Thank you.
Senator Heinrich.
Mr. Comey, prior to January 27th of this year, have you ever had a one-on-one meeting or a private dinner with a president of the United States?
No. I met dinner, no. I had two one-on-ones with President Obama that I laid out in my testimony, once to talk about law enforcement issues, law enforcement and race, which was an important topic throughout for me and for the president, and then once very briefly for him to say goodbye.
Were those brief interactions?
No. The one about law enforcement and race and policing, we spoke for probably over an hour, just the two of us.
How unusual is it to have a one-on-one dinner with the president? Did that strike you as odd?
Yeah, so much so that I assumed there would be others, that he couldn't possibly be having dinner with me alone.
Did the president, in any of those interactions that you've shared with us today, ask you what you should be doing or what our government should be doing or the intelligence community to protect America against Russian interference in our election system?
I don't recall a conversation like that.
Never?
No.
Do you find it odd?
Not with President Trump.
Right.
I attended a fair number of meetings on that with President Obama.
A lot of this comes down to who should we believe. Do you want to say anything as to why we should believe you?
Probably, my mother raised me not to say things like this about myself, so I'm not going to. I think people should look at the whole body of my testimony, because as I used to say to juries, that when I talked about a witness, you can't cherry pick it. You can't say, I like these things he said, but on this, he's a dirty, rotten liar.
Right.
You got to take it all together, and I've tried to be open and fair and transparent and accurate. A really significant fact to me is, so why did he kick everybody out of the Oval Office? Why would you kick the Attorney General, the President, the Chief of Staff out to talk to me if it was about something else? And so that to me, as an investigator, is a very significant fact.
And as we look at testimony or as communication from both of you, we should probably be looking for consistency.
Well, in looking at any witness, you look at consistency, track record, demeanor, record over time, that sort of thing.
Thank you. So there are reports that the incoming Trump administration, either during the transition and or after the inauguration, attempted to set up a sort of backdoor communication channel with the Russian government using their infrastructure, their devices or facilities. What would be the risks, particularly for a transition, someone not actually in the office of the president yet, to setting up unauthorized channels with a hostile foreign government, especially if they were to evade our own American intelligence services?
I'm not going to comment on whether that happened in an open setting, but the primary risk is obvious. You spare the Russians the cost and effort of having to break into our communications channels by using theirs. And so you make it a whole lot easier for them to capture all of your conversations. And then to use those to the benefit of Russia against the United States.
Mr. Comey, when you were terminated at the FBI, I said and still continue to feel that you have provided years of great service to the country. I also said that I'd had significant questions over the last year about some of the decisions you made. If the president hadn't terminated your service, would you still be, in your opinion, the director of the FBI today?
Yes, sir.
So you took as a direction from the president something that you thought was serious and troublesome, but continued to show up for work the next day?
Yes, sir.
And 6 weeks later, we're still telling the president on March the 30th that he was not personally the target of any investigation.
Correct. On March the 30th, and I think again on April 11th as well, I told him we're not investigating him personally. That was true.
Well, the point to me, the concern to me there is that all these things are going on. You now, in retrospect, or at least you now to this committee, that these were, you had serious concerns about what the president had, you believe, directed you to do, and had taken no action hadn't even reported up the chain of command, assuming you believe there isn't up the chain of command, that these things had happened. Do you have a sense of that looking back, that that was a mistake?
No. In fact, I think no action was the most important thing I could do to make sure there was no interference with the investigation. Now,
you know, you said the Attorney General said, I don't want to be in the room with him alone again, but you continued to talk to him on the phone. What is the difference in being in the room alone with him and talking to him on the phone alone?
Yeah, I think what I stressed to the Attorney General is a little broader than just the room. I said, I report to you, it's very important you be between me and the White House.
After that discussion with the Attorney General, did you take phone calls from the President?
Yes, sir.
So why did you just say you need to talk to, why didn't you say I'm not taking that call, you need to talk to the Attorney General?
Well, I did on the April 11th call, and I reported the calls, the March 30th call and the April 11th call, to my superior, who was the acting Deputy Attorney General.
What kind of information did you give to a friend?
That the Flynn conversation, that the President had asked me to let the Flynn, I mean, I'm forgetting my exact own words, but the conversation in the Oval Office.
So you didn't consider your memo or your sense of that conversation to be a government document. You considered it to be somehow your own personal document that you could share with the media as you wanted to?
Correct.
Through a friend?
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the President. As a private citizen, I felt free to share that. I thought it very important to get it out.
So were all of your memos that you recorded on classified or other documents, memos that might be yours as a private citizen?
Oh, yeah, not the classified documents. Unclassified, I don't have any of them anymore, but I gave them to the special counsel. But, yeah, my view was that the content of those unclassified, the memorialization of those conversations was my recollection recorded.
So why didn't you give those to somebody yourself rather than give them through a third party?
Because I was worried the media was camping at the end of my driveway at that point, and I was actually going out of town with my wife to hide, and I worried it would be like feeding seagulls at the beach if it was I who gave it to the media. So I asked my friend, make sure this gets out.
Senator King.
Mr. Comey, a broad question. Was the Russian activity in the 2016 election a one-off proposition, or is this part of a long-term strategy? Will they be back?
Oh, it's a long-term practice of theirs. It stepped up a notch in a significant way in 16. They'll be back.
That's my observation. I don't think Putin is a Republican or a Democrat. He's an opportunist.
I think that's a fair statement.
With regard to the several of these conversations, in his interview with Lester Holt on NBC, the President said, I had dinner with him. He wanted to have dinner because he wanted to stay on. Is this an accurate statement?
No, sir.
Did you in any way initiate that dinner?
No. He called me at my desk at lunchtime and asked me, was I free for dinner that night? And called himself and said, can you come over for dinner tonight? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, six work. I think he said six first. And then he said, I was going to invite your whole family, but we'll do that next time. I wanted you to come over. And is that a good time? I said, sir, whatever works for you. And then he said, how about 6:30? And I said, whatever works for you, sir. And then I hung up and had to call my wife and break a date with her. I was supposed to take her out to dinner that night.
That's one of the all-time great excuses for breaking a date.
Yeah. In retrospect, I love spending time with my wife. I wish I'd been there that night.
That's one question I'm not going to follow up, Mr. Comey. But in that same interview, the President said, in one case I called him and in one case he called me. Is that an accurate statement?
No.
Did you ever call the President?
No. I might. The only reason I'm hesitating is I think there was at least one conversation where I was asked to call the White House switchboard to be connected to him, but I never initiated a communication with the President.
What do you know about the Russian bank VEB?
Nothing that I can talk about in an open setting.
Well, I know my next three questions.
I know it exists. Yes, sir.
You know it exists. Did the FBI ever brief the Trump administration about the advisability of interacting directly with Ambassador Kislyak?
I think all I can say sitting here is there were a variety of defensive briefings given to the incoming administration about the counterintelligence risk.
Back to Mr. Flynn, would closing out the Flynn investigation have impeded the overall Russian investigation?
No. Unlikely, except to the extent, there's always a possibility if you have a criminal case against someone and you bring in and squeeze them, you flip them, and they give you information about something else. But I saw the two as touching each other, but separate.
With regard to your memos, isn't it true that in a court case, when you're weighing evidence, contemporaneous memos and contemporaneous statements to third parties are considered probative in terms of the validity of testimony?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cotton. Or excuse me, Senator Langford.
Your notes are obviously exceptionally important because they give a very rapid account of what you wrote down and what you perceived happened in those different meetings. Have you had the opportunity to be able to reference those notes when you were preparing the written statement that you put for us today?
Yes.
The individual that you told about your memos that then was sent on to the New York Times, did they have a copy of those memos or were they told orally of those memos?
Had a copy at the time.
Do they still have a copy of those memos?
It's a good question. I think so. I guess I can't say for sure sitting here, but I guess I don't know, but I think so.
So the question is, could you ask them to hand that copy right back to you so you could hand them over to this committee?
Potentially.
Is there any question that the president is not real fond of this investigation? I can think of multiple 140-word character expressions that he's done publicly to express he's not fond of the investigations. I've heard you share before in this conversation that you're trying to keep the agents that are working on it away from any comment the president might have made. Quite frankly, the president has informed around 6 billion people that he's not real fond of this investigation. Do you think there's a difference in that?
Yes.
Okay.
I think there's a big difference in kicking superior officers out of the Oval Office, looking the FBI director in the eye and saying, I hope you let this go. I think if the agents, as good as they are, heard the President of the United States did that,
so to you,
there's a real risk of a chilling effect on their work. That's okay. Why we kept it so tight.
Okay. And then you made a comment earlier about the Attorney General, previous Attorney General, asking you about the investigation on the Clinton emails, saying that you've been asked not to call it an investigation anymore, but to call it a matter. And you had said that confused you. Can you give us additional details on that?
Well, it concerned me because we were at the point where we had refused to confirm the existence, as we typically do, of an investigation for months. And it was getting to a place where that looked silly because the campaigns were talking about interacting with the FBI in the course of our work. The Clinton campaign at the time was using all kinds of euphemisms, security review, matters, things like that, for what was going on. We were getting to a place where the Attorney General and I were both going to have to testify and talk publicly about it. And I wanted to know, was she going to authorize us to confirm we had an investigation? And she said, yes, but don't call it that. Call it a matter. And I said, why would I do that? And she said, just call it a matter. And again, you look back in hindsight, you think, should I have resisted harder? I just said, all right, this isn't a hill worth dying on. And so I just said, okay, the press is going to completely ignore it. And that's what happened. When I said, we have opened a matter, they all reported the FBI has an investigation open. And so that concerned me because that language tracked the way the campaign was talking about the FBI's work.
Senator Manchin.
Do you believe there were any tapes or recordings of your conversations with the president?
It never occurred to me till the president's tweet. I'm not being facetious. I hope there are, and I'll consent to the release of...
So both of you are in the same findings here. You both hope there's tapes and recordings. And you also mentioned you had, six meetings, three times in person, six on the phone, nine times in conversation with the president. Did he ever at that time allude that you were not performing adequately, ever indicate that at all?
Oh, no. In fact, the contrary, quite often. Yeah, he called me one day. I was about to get on a helicopter. The head of the DEA was waiting in the helicopter for me, and he just called to check in and tell me I was doing an awesome job and wanted to see how I was doing. And I said, I'm doing fine, sir. And then I finished the call and got on the helicopter.
Mr. Comey, do you believe you would have been fired if Hillary Clinton had become president?
That's a great question. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Senator Cotton.
In your statement for the record, you cite 9 private conversations with the president, 3 meetings, and 2 phone calls. There are 4 phone calls that are not discussed in your statement for the record. What happened in those phone calls?
President called me, I believe, shortly before he was inaugurated as a follow-up to our conversation, private conversation, on January the 6th. He just wanted to reiterate his rejection of the allegation and talk about he'd thought about it more and why he thought it wasn't true, the verified and unverified and salacious parts. And during that call, he asked me, again, hope you're going to stay. You're doing a great job. And I told him that I intended to. There was another phone call that I mentioned, I think was, could have the date wrong, March the 1st, where he called just to check in with me as I was about to get on the helicopter. There was a secure call we had about an operational matter that was not related to any of this, about something the FBI was working on. He wanted to make sure that I understood how important he thought it was, a totally appropriate call. And then the 4th call, I'm probably forgetting, I may have meant the call when he called to invite me to dinner. I'll think about it as I'm answering other questions, but I think I got that right.
Mr. Comey, in 2004, you were a part of a well-publicized event about an intelligence program that had been recertified several times, and you were acting Attorney General when Attorney General John Ashcroft was incapacitated due to illness. There was a dramatic showdown at the hospital here. The next day, you said that you wrote a letter of resignation and signed it before you went to meet with President Bush to explain why you refused to certify it. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think so.
At any time in the 3.5 months you were the FBI director during the Trump administration, did you ever write and sign a letter of recommendation and leave it on your desk?
Letter of resignation? No, sir.
Letter of resignation?
No, sir.
So despite all of the things that you've testified to here today, you didn't feel this rose to the level of an honest but serious difference of legal opinion between accomplished and skilled lawyers in that 2004 episode?
I wouldn't characterize the circumstances in 2004 that way, but to answer, no, I didn't encounter any circumstance that led me to intend to resign, consider to resign. No, sir.
Thank you.
Senator Harris.
As a former Attorney General, I have a series of questions about your connection with the Attorney General during the course of your tenure as director. What is your understanding of the parameters of General Sessions' recusal from the Russia investigation?
I think it's described in a written release or statement from DOJ, which I don't remember sitting here, but the gist was he would be recused from all matters relating to Russia and the campaign or activities of Russia and the 16 election, I think, something like that.
And the Attorney General recused himself from the investigation, but do you believe it was appropriate for him to be involved in the firing of the chief investigator of that case, of that Russia interference?
That's something I can't answer sitting here. It's a reasonable question, but that would depend on a lot of things I don't know. Like, what did he know? What was he told? Did he realize that the president was doing it because of the Russia investigation? Things like that. I just don't know the answer.
You've mentioned in your written testimony in here that the president essentially asked you for a loyalty pledge. Are you aware of him making the same request of any other members of the cabinet?
I am not.
Do you know one way or another what he...
I don't know one way or another. I've never heard anything about it.
And on that same February 14th meeting, you said you understood the president to be requesting that you drop the investigation. After that meeting, however, you received 2 calls from the president, March 30th and April 11th, where the president talked about a cloud over his presidency. Has anything you've learned in the months since your February 14th meeting changed your understanding of the president's request? I guess it would be what he has said in public documents or public interviews?
Correct.
Okay.
Senator Cornyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a general matter, if an FBI agent has reason to believe that a crime has been committed, do they have a duty to report it?
That's a good question. I don't know that there's a legal duty to report it. They certainly have a cultural, ethical duty to report it.
You're unsure whether they would have a legal duty?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've not thought about it before. I don't know where the legal... There's a statute that prohibits misprision of a felony, knowing of a felony, and taking steps to conceal it, but this is a different question. And so, look, let me be clear. I would expect any FBI agent who has reason, information about a crime being committed, to report it.
Me too.
But where you rest that obligation, I don't know. It exists.
Let me take you back to the Clinton email investigation. It seems to me that you clearly believe that Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, had an appearance of a conflict of interest on the Clinton email investigation. Is that correct?
I think that's fair. I didn't believe she could credibly decline that investigation, at least not without grievous damage to the Department of Justice and to the FBI.
And under Department of Justice and FBI norms, wouldn't it have been appropriate for the Attorney General, or if she had recused herself, which she did not do, for the Deputy Attorney General to appoint a special counsel? That's essentially what's happened now with Director Mueller. Would that have been an appropriate step in the Clinton email investigation, in your opinion?
Certainly a possible step, yes, sir.
And were you aware that Ms. Lynch had been requested numerous times to appoint a special counsel and had refused?
I think members of Congress had repeatedly asked, yes, sir.
Well, if a special counsel had been appointed, they could have made that determination that there was nothing there and declined to pursue it, right?
Sure, but it would have been many months later or a year later.
Let me just ask you to, given the experience of the Clinton email investigation and what happened there, do you think it's unreasonable for anyone, any president, who has been assured on multiple occasions that he's not the subject of an FBI investigation, do you think it's unreasonable for them to want the FBI director to publicly announce that so that this cloud over his administration would be removed?
I think that's a reasonable point of view. The concern would be, obviously, because if that boomerang comes back, it's going to be a very big deal because there will be a duty to correct.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with, wonder what institution that could be. Is it the Heritage Foundation? No. Is it Institute for Policy Studies? I don't think so. It's the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Senate Intelligence Committee for conducting this hearing. You guys really need to start promoting the Lawfare podcast. Rate us, tweet us, share us on Facebook. Tell people at dinner parties to be annoying and talk about the Lawfare podcast. I would say that our music is performed by Sophia Yan, except on these special editions, we actually don't do music. Normally our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Today, we don't have any music. Thanks.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.